Hello everyone, this is Mike Quincy connecting the light. My guest today is Alexander Price, who is a writer and Sufi dervish, who considers himself blessed to have had many wonderful spiritual friends and guides in this lifetime. He's recently released a book, which we are going to discuss, called 2012 and the Shift of Ages, A Guide to the End of the World. So, welcome to the program, Alexander.
Thank you. Hi. Thank you for having me.
I noticed that you have also said that you are the founder of the Makaranti Mystery School.
Sure.
Perhaps it would be nice to explain how that came about and what it stands for.
Makaranti is a Sanskrit word, and it's kind of in the Hindu traditions, you know, a reference to Armageddon, in a sense, the end of the world, but also especially a spiritual revolution that they're expecting, you know, at the end of time. So there's a connection, you know, between the mystery schools and these very, very ancient ideas about, you know, religious mythology about the origin, fate of the universe, and they're both outer and inner meanings. And so in the Makaranti school, we focus more on those inner experiences where, you know, you can experience your own end of the world without having to wait for the big crunch.
Now, you tell us that you were a dervish in the Sufi order for seven years. Now, tell us a little bit about what a dervish is, and how did you find yourself in that particular order? I mean, what was the purpose?
I think it really started, I was living in New York City, and I've always been a very avid reader, and at the time I was reading Robert Anton Wilson, has some, you know, wonderful books and ideas, and he mentioned the Sufis, and also in particular a writer named Idris Shah, who I just became obsessed with and read everything he'd ever written, and then that led eventually through some internet searching for me to connect with this order in it was originally at the time in New York City, and they moved into upstate New York, where they have a derga, which is kind of is very similar to an ashram. You know, it's land at the top of the mountain, and so on. And so you know, I became connected with them, and I ended up moving and living in this religious community for many years, and it was a very special experience.
Yes, you said during that period of time you formed very powerful and enduring bonds with a distinguished lineage of enlightened masters. Perhaps it would be nice to hear a little bit about that as well.
Sure. The Naqshbandi lineage is, that's the name of the Sufi order, the Naqshbandi, which comes from a particular Sufi saint named Shah Naqshband. A medieval Sufi mystic, but you know, all Sufi lineages trace their origins back to the Prophet Muhammad in, you know, the 8th century AD, and the Naqshbandi order is different in a few ways. They call themselves a silent order, and it's also known as Uwaisi, which means, you know, they teach silently or by heart, or, you know, as we might want to call it, like telepathically, is one of the abilities that that initiates in this order are, you know, blessed with, if your sheikh chooses to open that. So, you know, they had, our sheikh, his name is Abdul Karim, and he is a direct grandson of Rumi, you know, who's a wonderful and wonderful poet, and this is the 40th Grand Sheikh right now. We have his name, Sheikh Nazim, and he lives in Cyprus. And the Sufi tradition, you know, the prophecy that they have is that there are only going to be 40 Naqshbandi Grand Sheikhs. And since he's the 40th, he's very old now. I think he's almost 90. And they say, you know, after he passes announces that he's the last one, there's not going to be that's when the end of the world is coming. That time period, and that's what we're living in.
Now, it would appear from the details you've given about your book that you've evidently done a lot of research about the beliefs of people in the ancient world, and you mentioned that they saw human life as deeply connected with great cycles of nature, which, again, from the title of the different chapters of your book, it sounds as though you very much agree with that.
Absolutely. And I, you know, for as much as I like to be very much experientially involved in all of these mystical ideas, I like to experience as much as to learn, but I'm also very skeptical, so I don't just swallow anything that comes along without looking at it critically. So in my book, I try to take a very critical look and really see from the source, you know, original writings that still exist, what these ancient people really said in Mesopotamia, in Egypt, in Mesoamerica, like the Aztecs. I was really trying to take a step back and say, were they all saying the same thing? What were they saying? And do we have any justification to think that there's anything special going on right now?
Yes, I remember very much doing something of a similar nature a long time ago when I was trying to find out the validity or the truth in Orthodox religion, and my approach was to go back as far as I could into ancient history to find out what they thought, and I found that a useful connection. So you've done something similar there. Now, you found that the people in the past believed that humans go through cycles in which significant events repeat. Now, what type of events are we talking about?
I mean, it depends. I find, you know, the idea of fractal geometry very helpful for understanding the idea, you know, where in a fractal image, I don't know if you've seen them, they have animations online where it's this beautiful and kind of abstract mathematical image where if you zoom in on a particular point and zoom in and zoom in, after you go in a few levels, you'll find that you're back at the original image. So you can go as small as you want or as big as you want, and you're going to see the same picture. So I think in the same way, you know, that there are cycles that happen on a huge intergalactic scale and on a very small scale just from day to day. So on some sense, you know, we're talking about the birth and death of planets or civilizations, and then on another level we're also talking about reincarnation and the birth and death of the individual.
Right. Now, you've apparently, in your own words, made a penetrating study into the history of astrology, ancient religion, secret societies, and the evolution of consciousness, which is clearly contained in your book. But where does astrology fit in, do you think?
Wow, yeah, that's a tough one, because I was also, you know, particularly skeptical about astrology when I first came to the subject. In a nutshell, you know, where it comes in is in the mystery schools in ancient Greece, they taught that the zodiac was a symbol for what has been called the cycle of initiation, where you enter into the circle when you're born at a certain point. I think that they said it was the symbol Capricorn, and then you slowly descend into the material world, and then they were concerned with cycling back out the other side, out of the material world and up into the spiritual reality. And so, you know, that is present. That circle of the zodiac is present in the physical body, which is something that breath work and Kundalini yoga starts to work with. But then, you know, on a much bigger scale, like when people who are interested in 2012 are possibly familiar with like the idea of the precession of the equinoxes, where the sun every 3,000 years or so shifts from one sun sign to the next, and it takes a very long time. I think 12,000 years to get through half of it. So 26. It actually varies, but about it's a cycle of about 25,000 years that the sun takes to circle all the way around the zodiac.
And the solar cycle, in fact.
What's that?
The solar cycle.
Yeah, it actually has to do, it's kind of complicated. It has to do with the Earth's equator in relation to the sky. So it takes, the basic idea is that it takes, 25,000 years for the zodiac to make one complete circle. And that is what's referred to, as the shift of ages, is that moving from one sign to the next, but especially, one cycle is supposed to be, a huge deal. And that's what we're coming to right now, especially as we're approaching 2012, is the end of one of those gigantic 25,000-year cycles that supposed to be, once we start over on a new one, that's supposed to be a huge, huge major event that I don't know what's going to happen, but it would be certainly be the kind of point where a big cataclysm or like the end of life as we know it would certainly fit into, that pattern, although what comes after the end of life as we know it could be very wonderful. It doesn't necessarily have to mean complete annihilation.
Right. I remember reading that the soul has to go through each sign of the zodiac as part of its experience. So in light of what you said, that would seem to make sense, wouldn't it?
Yes. And that's another idea that's like so ancient. If you really start looking, and I was able, to touch on a little of this in my book, that if you can trace it back, the circle of that zodiac, and especially like the idea of a hero going through that cycle, you can find that in ancient Greece with the story of Hercules and his 12 labors, and that even goes back to ancient Sumeria with Gilgamesh and these stories of him wrestling all the lions and it's a very, 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 very old story.
Yes, indeed. Now, let's start with part one of your book. You've actually become conversant with the Hopi way, and how has that influenced your beliefs about this period of time?
He was, in 2003, I think, was the first time I went and visited the Hopi Reservation, and I had been reading about the Hopi prophecies. The Hopis, were very traditionally very quiet about their religious beliefs, to the point that they had a reputation for being secretive. And then in the 1950s, right after World War II, all of a sudden this small group of Hopis came out and started spreading their prophecies. They really devoted their lives to letting people all around the world know that, according to their prophecies, they say the signs are all showing that this world is going to be ending soon. And so that started in the 1950s, and I had been under the impression that all of the people that were in that original group, they met with a huge amount of resistance from their community that did not want them sharing these very sacred teachings with the outside world. And I was under the impression that they had all passed away. But we still I went with a friend, and we still wanted to visit and, just make kind of a pilgrimage to this holy area, the Hopi land. And when we were there, one thing led to another, and we just very magically found ourselves inside the home of this elder named Martin Gashwesteoma. And he is one of that original group, and he shared, he brought out these a photocopy of this Aztec scroll, which he said, I can read this because the Hopis and the Aztecs were originally the same people, so I can tell you what this story is. in this ancient Aztec writing. And so actually in the book in 2012 in The Shift of Ages, I included the first ever complete English translation of that Aztec codex. It's actually not complete, but it's the first ever English translation that gives you, you know, the whole the scholarly interpretation from based on, you know, some academic readings of the story. And so he, you know, that was how my involvement with the Hopi started. My grandfather Martin brought out all of these after the Aztec scrolls. You know, he brought out other books and religious items that, you know, I had to go home and start researching. Like, he didn't just give me all of the answers, but I had to go home and start really looking into, like, why did he show me this? What did that mean to him? And that's when I started getting into some subjects that for me were very bizarre, like Atlantis and Lemuria and Earth changes and pole shifts and those kinds of things. But so that was coming from Grandfather Martin and the kind of esoteric mystical teachings that he shared with me from that Native American tradition.
Right. Now, I know that in part 5 of your book, is it, or part 2, chapter 5, you do in fact refer to Atlantis and Lemuria, but more interestingly, you talk about the Hindu account of mankind's journey to Earth from the Pleiades star system. Now, you obviously don't want to give away everything that's in the book, but I'm sure, like myself, the listeners would be interested to know about that link with the Pleiades.
Yeah, it's something, you know, that I think is very exciting and fascinating also, because the Pleiades, you know, if you it comes up a lot in New Age and sort of mystical circles, this, you know, nobody's you know, different people have different ideas. You know, there are so many people who say that they're in communication with entities from that system, but it's out of the entire sky, this particular star cluster comes up a lot in conversation. So it was very exciting to me to see this Hindu guru who has an ashram out in Hawaii, and he has this wonderful, wonderful book where he says, you know, that this book is from, it was written in Lemuria, and tells the story of our humankind's migration to this planet from the Pleiades star system. But that's another thing, that if you look back to the earliest human civilizations and their stories of where we came from, you know, there's that number 7 is always vitally important. Like there were the 7 gates in ancient Greece, and then the 7 they're called the 7 sages or rishis in Hinduism, or the 7 apkalu, which are sages in the Sumerian Mesopotamian tradition. You know, there are always these 7 entities that are bringing civilization to the planet. So his name was Shivaya Subramunya Swami, was talking about from the Hindu perspective, he's saying, you know, that millions, you know, maybe 4 million years ago, our souls migrated to this planet from that system, that's where this entire human race is from, and you know, that we came here together to learn, because we needed a fire planet, a place to kind of shake us up a little bit, cause some conflict that would spark some spiritual growth. And, you know, and he says that at that time, you know, we didn't have physical bodies yet. We came in our soul bodies, and that's why there's no evidence of Atlantis or Lemuria or these ancient civilizations, because they didn't, like, it took, you know, so many millions of years for us to enter into the material world, and which partly came, you know, as some of the humans who had migrated here were forming, you know, some stronger, subtle bodies, and were eventually eaten by animals. And entered into an animal reincarnation cycle and were reborn with an animal nervous system in that way. And so, according to him, that's why it appears that humans evolved from the apes when, in fact, you know, we had come here from, millions of years ago from the star system, and it only appears that we evolved out of apes because we entered into the animal reincarnation cycle, you know, several million years ago, and are just now beginning to reemerge out of it and remember where we came from.
Yes. Well, certainly, in a lot of stories about our extraterrestrial friends, it is indicated that the Pleiades was really our original home, if there's such a thing. So I can quite believe that millions of years ago that many souls migrated to this system. It does, of course, indicate that we have infinite life, and where you're talking about 2012 as being the end, presumably you also see that as the beginning of something else.
Right, because it's cycles, they're circles, they're... It's the end of one cycle, but there is no really like the idea that time is linear isn't something that I think comes naturally out of, you know, people's experience of the world. That, you know, the people who are closest to nature, the indigenous people all around the world, still experience time as cyclical, you know, as the cycle of the plant life and the seasons and those recurring cycles over and over is how they see, you know, the structure of time itself. And personally, I think that the idea of linear time is a consequence of, you know, the birth of writing that happened in, you know, the Middle East. Maybe what I think it was about 4,000 years ago when people started writing books. You know, it's a book that has to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and that kind of gives us the idea that stories also have to have a starting place in time and an ending place in time. And I think that that really contributed significantly to why we think today that time is a line that started somewhere and is going to end somewhere.
Yes. Yes. While you're living in linear time, it's very difficult to comprehend the fact, as many spiritual teachers tell us, that we're living in the now and everything is in the now.
Yeah. And the past and the future are just in your mind. They're kind
yes.
of illusions created by a certain way of thinking.
Yes. It's strange to take that on board, but never mind. I certainly believe it. Now, you also speak in your book about the path of the sun, and in astrological terms, that is it not the most important aspect when one is sort of giving an astrological chart? How do you see the sun yourself?
You know, I don't know quite as much about astrology per se as more of like the mythology of. I was really especially interested in the mythology of the constellations because I knew that the star map we have today with all of these, you know, 12 symbols of the zodiac and all the so many, maybe 300 or some odd constellations in the sky, is something that we inherited from Greece and that Greece inherited from Mesopotamia. And I knew that at that time they considered the stars and especially the planets to be gods. So I was looking at how these constellations fit into their mythology. But if you also look, you know, a lot of esoteric systems say that the whole solar system is contained within each individual human body. So, you know, there's the chakras that are the energy centers distributed along the spines. Represent
yes.
the seven planets as they were recognized in the ancient world. And so the sun would be a symbol, you know, of your consciousness. I mean, obviously,
right.
It's both a symbol and a reality at the same time. But so that's more
yeah.
how I understand the sun is as you know, that light that shines within you that makes you able to know anything.
Yes. I mean, I have read stories or teachings, again, which suggest that on one level, the sun actually contains beings of a very high state of spiritual evolution. So the sun itself has a consciousness level.
I'm sure. And if you look, there's a book, the founder of the Hare Krishna movement wrote a book about journeying to the other planets within our solar system in the astral world, like using how yogis are able to, you know, master a certain breathwork technique that allows them to visit the other planets. And he, according to him, he says, you know, all of the planets in the solar system are inhabited, excuse me, not just the Earth, and that it's just because we, our consciousness is kind of dialed into this planet is the only reason that we can see that, is the only reason it appears to us that we're alone. But, you know, he says that all, the sun and all of the planets are have their own different kinds of beings living there.
I gather that in prehistoric and ancient religions, you were evidently very interested in the symbolism or the use of the bull.
Bull, yeah.
How would you speak of that one?
That came up because when I was looking into the Greek mystery schools, it was obvious that the bull slaughter in the Mysteries of Mithras was you know, like the central significant moment where the culmination of this, the soul's journey through the zodiac happened. It was symbolized for them in this sacrifice of the bull, and so I wanted to understand. You know, obviously it was all zodiac symbolism, and so the bull, you know, thus it would be natural to assume that the bull was Taurus. And so that kind of is what initiated, you know, that search into the meanings of the ancient constellations. And I really did focus a lot on Taurus and the bull symbol. And if you look, you know, the bull was you know, a central symbol in ancient Egyptian and especially Mesopotamian religion, and also, you know, their iconography, their art. You see bulls everywhere. And I was talking a moment ago about the Epic of Gilgamesh. There's another moment, you know, where the goddess Inanna sends the bull of heaven to try and destroy the hero, and he slaughters the bull. And so this bull slaughter just keeps coming up over and over. If you look in ancient Egypt, there was a sacred bull called the Apis bull, who was a symbol of the god Osiris. And they found, you know, mummified bulls. And there's also, you know, the story of Osiris being killed by his brother Set. And some of the ancient texts refer to him, you know, being slaughtered in the form of a bull, which this was reenacted every year by the priests in the temple, symbolically, you know, atoning for the murder of Osiris through the sacrifice of this bull. So the bull sacrifice, you know, is something that it goes back to obviously way before any historical records exist anymore, and it seems, you know, you know, I see ancient religion emerging a lot out of shamanism, and you know, that there are a lot of anthropologists that say that, you know, this is the world's oldest religious paradigm is shamanism, and so the bull cult is one of, you know, the oldest that we have any evidence of. If you look even all the way back to the cave paintings in the caves in France, you know, there's bulls everywhere, and this is
I've seen a lot of drawings or photographs of those cave paintings, and I recall you're quite correct in that respect. Now, Egypt has been at least ancient Egypt has been a place that's very much fascinated me. But you're mentioning Osiris. Do I remember correctly that he was cut up and then effectively sort of reassembled again?
Right. Yeah.
So what was do you think that symbolized when he was sort of resurrected, or is that all it meant?
It's hard to know what that symbolized to people at the time. More recently, I have seen some very interesting interpretations by psychologists who understand it kind of as a symbol. You know, there's something right now they're calling it dissociative identity disorder, but it's what they used to call multiple personality.
Yes.
And even before it was called multiple personality, they called it like an Osiris effect or the Osiris complex. That's what it was. The Osiris complex was their original name for multiple personality. So in that sense, I can see it symbolizing, you know, the division of the universe into what seem to be separate and disconnected parts. And so in the story, you know, it's his wife Isis who gathers all the pieces of his body back together again and reassembles him as the god of the underworld. And so, you know, I can see that as being, you know, the symbolic of, you know, the power of love bringing back all of the apparently multiple and individual elements of reality back together again and reassimilating them until we're able to experience, you know, what might be called unity consciousness or the oneness of all existence or God.
Right. Now, you also mentioned about the ascension of the pharaoh.
Yeah.
What was it that attracted you to the pharaoh dynasty?
Well, I guess what attracted me was more the fact that the pharaohs were the ones who could afford to have scribes, and so they're the first ones who have any written evidence of what they thought and what they believed. You know, we don't really have the same records for the general population, but from the very beginning of writing, religion was associated with the state. So religion was always state religion from as early as we have written records. And so I guess that's how I got specifically interested in the pharaoh. But he was, you know, seen as special, you know, different in spiritual ways in addition to being different just socially.
Right. So did you process the known history of each pharaoh to arrive at your conclusions about that?
What I was looking at were more, there's a certain series of texts that the what we call the Egyptian Book of the Dead is one stage in the evolution of a series of texts. Like before that, there were the coffin texts, and they're called coffin texts because they were often found written actually physically on a coffin or inside a coffin, and they appear to be, you know, a map that would give the deceased instructions on what to do after death and how to proceed in the afterworld in order to ascend to godhood and specifically to pass through the underworld safely and ascend in the constellation of Orion. Was where it happened.
Yes. It's interesting to think that possibly their death occupied their minds far more during their life than life itself.
Sure. Yes, and that's what initiation is about. That's what mystery schools are about. They're about the secrets of death. You know, they're about moving beyond the visible world to the unseen world. And, you know, some mystery schools are about experiencing that in this world, and some are just about preparing you, you know, for the experience of death. But you know, that experience of death is really vitally important, because that's, you know, that they say that how you die is what determines where you go next.
Right. I'll move on to Mesopotamia now,
sure.
Which features in one of your chapters. You connect it, rightly so, and I think most people have heard of the Epic of Gilgamesh, but I must admit, if somebody asked me what it was about, I couldn't remember.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us what was so special about that story.
The Epic of Gilgamesh is about a historical king, you know, in ancient Mesopotamia. Of course, the stories were elaborated and mythologized, so it's not really like a biography in the sense that we would think of it now, but it's a story about Gilgamesh, who was king of the ancient city of Uruk. And, you know, he was supposedly this like larger than life, figure who, was, just, you know, having so much fun being king that the people complained to the gods because he was drinking, you know, all the beer and he was taking all of the virgins and just making life very difficult for everybody. And, so that's how, he attracted the attention of the goddess Inanna, who came and asked, you know, for him to marry her. And he not only said no, but he just like gave her this long list of reasons why it would be a horrible idea for him to marry her, because, you know, every single one of her former lovers had ended their lives very tragically at her hands, and she was just like this horrible, horrible person, basically. And so she went up to her father, the god, I can't remember his name offhand, but and complained, you know, that Gilgamesh had said all these horrible things about her. And so her father gave her permission to take the Bull of Heaven to try and, you know, go destroy Gilgamesh. And that was the constellation Taurus. And so she brought the constellation down to Earth, and Gilgamesh and his friend slaughtered it. And the story goes on, you know, Gilgamesh receives a curse. I can't remember if it was Inanna who cursed him. It's been a while since I looked at all this, but his buddy, essentially his best friend, dies, and the experience of seeing his friend die really changes him, and so he leaves his life and goes out wandering for looking for the secret of immortality, which leads him eventually past, you know, the mountains where the sun rises, and into this mystical realm where he encounters the first human, and first and only human to ever attain immortality. And that figure he encounters is named Utnapishtim, and he supposedly lived before the flood. So that's one of the points where these Mesopotamian stories overlap with the stories that we have in the Bible. You know, that they also have myths about things that happened before the flood. And So Utnapishtim, I think, is just a fascinating character because he's another one who all of these mystics in different groups throughout history have said, oh, that's the same as the Jewish Elijah, and this is the same as the Islamic Al-Hizr, the Green Man, or the Green Knight in the Arthurian cycle. But everybody, you know, says, you know, we know this immortal person supposedly is a real person that the Sufis say is still present.
Right. Now, do I recall correctly that the god you're referring to was Anu?
Ah, that sounds right. God of the sky.
Why I'm mentioning that is I have read stories by Sacharaya Sitchin,
uh-huh.
who you've possibly, no doubt have heard of or read his work, and he connects a lot of the happenings with the gods, goddesses with the Anunnaki.
Mm-hmm.
Have you any thoughts about that, the validity of his claims?
You know, I have heard of him. I'm not 100% familiar, you know, with his writings themselves. If I'm not mistaken, it has something to do also, you know, with the fall, you know, like the idea of fallen angels or fallen humanity from a previous state. Does that sound right?
Yes, yes.
Hmm. So, that's something that I've studied separately. The origins of the idea of fallen angels, and that, you know, gives rise eventually to the belief in Satan, which wasn't originally a part of Judaism. But you know, there's a woman named Jalila Starr who talks more about the return of Nibiru and the more esoteric inner meanings of these kinds of stories, of the pole shift especially. She has some really wonderful writings about the pole shift and what that means to each one of us individually. But I think that she's probably a better person to look at for.
Right. I can't claim to have read all the work of Satchari, but I must say, when you read his translations of the Sumerian history, you can read into that a lot that appears to have been put into the Old Testament in the Bible. The stories, even to the extent of mentioning the same names, are in there.
Uh-huh.
So
yes.
It's interesting how it relates like that.
Yes, I mean, and there's a lot of scholars, like at NYU and at Harvard, who, you know, they're really not looking so much from the mystical or religious side, just from the historical side, and they're trying to look, you know, for the backgrounds of the Bible, and they find a lot of those stories. I mean, the Bible is very, very much a book that's coming out of a Mesopotamian context.
Yes.
And it's really fascinating to me to look at that transition. There's a guy named Mark Smith who writes wonderful books about the origins of monotheism, and he's saying, you know, that Judaism, you can even look at the Bible that we have right now and see places where it was not originally a monotheistic book, even that you know, this is coming from people who used to believe in the existence of many gods.
Right, yes.
And it was only very, very, very late, you know, maybe in the 6th century BC, that someone went through and edited the book to change it, to make it about, you know, to fit with this idea of Yahweh being the only God who had ever existed.
Yeah. I find it interesting in Egyptian history, they had a god or a goddess for virtually everything, but they seemed individually to symbolize a certain type of energy.
Right.
Whereas we see one god that is all powerful. And I can understand how they reached those ideas to account for each type of energy that these gods or goddesses represented. But of course that changed somewhat when Akhenaten came along with his one god teaching, didn't it?
When who did?
Akhenaten.
Oh, there's something I would love to learn more about, because I haven't really been able to figure out where that idea of the one god was coming from. But I think you're absolutely right. And that's also, you know, one of the things that's fascinating to me about the symbol of the bull was the reason that I think a lot of the ancient people focused on the bull was that at the time, the bull that existed, it's extinct now, but the kind of bull that lived then was gigantic. I mean, really almost like you would imagine, like a prehistoric dinosaurs-type bull, like just this massive creature that symbolized, like, the ultimate power that they could, of anything that they saw in the world. So the bull was a symbol of really raw, masculine power. And that idea of power and God, you know, I think that even to God, you know, unconsciously we're talking about power.
Yes,
so I
yes.
totally agree, you know, that the gods are in many, you know, instances, you know, symbols of different powers or energies.
Mm.
But they're also powers and energies that we have inside ourselves.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Now, in part four of your book, interestingly enough, you start off talking about the divine harmony, about music use, divination, mm-hmm. healing, and prophecy in the ancient Near East. Are you involved in that type of music yourself?
You know, I have a harmonium that I'm trying to learn how to play, but
right.
I'm not very good at it. But I did, you know, from living with the Sufis, I did see how music was a very important part of their spirituality. And I experienced it more, you know, with the Hindus. I have a huge love for Hindu devotional music, and I had one of my, you know, biggest personal experiences, you know, with God through a few of the different Hindu orders after my time with the Sufis, after I had moved on. You know, I had some very powerful experiences with the Hindus and music, and I got it, you know, what that mysticism of music, why it was so important to them.
Is music used in that way almost hypnotic?
Is music used in which way?
Well, for divination and things like that.
Almost. Well, yeah, sure. I mean, drumming is another thing from shamanism that they use to help induce altered states of consciousness. So in that sense, you know, absolutely, it can be almost kind of a drug or a hypnotic. It can have a hypnotic effect, but you know, depending on who you are and where you are, it could also, you know, take you to different worlds.
Right. I mean, I can understand that certain types of music are conducive to healing. Is that the music that actually resonates with your chakras and sort of balances your body?
I believe that's the idea. You know, in the ancient Greece, they had a belief that each of the planets emitted a different tone that you know, you couldn't hear with your physical ear, but you know, your subtle body could perceive. And that's connected, you know, with the idea of the seven vowels and the seven tones. And you know, if you want to get into it, you can go very, very deep with the ideas of ascension and the, you know, the shift of consciousness that we're going through, and vibration and you know, reality as the way we experience it.
Indeed, yes. Certainly a lot of people these days use sound for healing, and I know from what I've read it's proved to be very successful. So maybe in some ways it appears to be something new, but in reality it's been used for years.
Oh, absolutely. The word catharsis is a Greek word that was specifically meant a spiritual healing that came about through the use of music, that they believed, you know, that through a certain application of sound, you know, you could produce this emotional experience where they would, like, bring all this garbage out of you so that, you know, the illness would leave, whatever was causing your sickness would, you know, come out of you. And, you know, I definitely believe that goes, it's not at all a recent idea, sure.
Now, in another chapter in part four, you're talking about the idea that time will end, will be credited to certain sources.
Mm-hmm.
What is your personal feeling? I mean, you did mention that maybe there will be a total cataclysm, but do you, like some, including myself, feel that there will also be an ascension?
I do. You know, I can see both possibilities. It could be a big, big, big event, like some of the Sufi prophecies about the end of the world say on the last day the sun is going to rise in the west, and there are metaphorical meanings for that, but if you look at it as in the context of a possible pole shift, like that's a way, if the poles were quite literally to shift, the sun would literally rise in the west one day, and that would be the end of things. But but I also kind of, another part of me says that it's not going to be anything like that, and that it's that the shift that's happening, that 2012, that like that one particular day on December 21st isn't going to be like, it's not really about that moment, but more about all of 100 or 200, 300 years leading up to it and coming after it, that whole process is what the shift is really about and when it's really happening. It's not something that you could really say happened at this particular moment, but when you look back, from a distance, you'll be able to see that was pretty major. It was a big time.
But I think regardless of how these different groups see the end time, one thing is certain, something's going to happen. And I think possibly the Mayans, with their calendar, have perhaps the best history or best prophecies that cover this period, and I know you've looked into that. What do you feel?
My feeling when I looked into the Mayan calendar was that the end of the world that the Mayan calendar predicted, that number one, that was what it predicted, but number two, that it had already happened 500 years ago, and the world for them, for the Mesoamerican people, for the Aztecs and the Mayans, the world did end 500 years ago when the conquistadors arrived and, just flattened their universe as they knew it. And I've seen people, there's a book called Just the Aztec Calendar that touches on this in a few places where, the cycles that the Mesoamerican, the Aztec and Mayan calendars talk about, can be connected with specific events in their history. Like they, like the Hopis, they would periodically have a group who would just pick up and leave the city where they were living and migrate to someplace else. And these authors connected, each one of those migrations with the end of a Mayan world or Aztec world. So, with reincarnation, the world is constantly ending over and over and over.
Right. Believe it or not, I'm going to have to stop you there because we're coming up to the last couple of minutes of the program. I need to thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much.
You might like to give out any website address or other information that you feel would be useful to people, and then I will announce our guests for next week. Do you have any final comment there? Have you got a website, indeed?
Yes, there's one for the Mahakranti School. Is at mahakranti.org. It's mahakranti.org. And then, I guess for my book, it's shiftofages.com, and you could just write it as one long word, and it's going to come right up.
Right, that's fine. This information will go into my archive report. So that is the MahakrantiSchool.org. Is that
Mahakranti.
Yeah. Okay, that's fine. Well, thank you very much for coming on to the program, Alexander. It's been very interesting talk.
Yeah.
I will now tell my listeners very quickly that next week I've got Jeffrey Grupp, who runs the Antimatter radio show. I should think that anything of the paranormal or otherwise that exists, he has investigated at some time, and he's brought out a new book called Telementation, which we will discuss. So thank you for being with me today. I'm sure you enjoyed it, and I look forward to you being with me next week. Thank you very much, everyone.